back to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's very, very special episode is entitled Barbenheimer. Have just had with the opening of both the new Barbie movie and Oppenheimer. We wouldn't be a film radio show in 2023 if we didn't do a Barbenheimer special. So we're talking all things Barbenheimer this week. We're specifically going to actually focus on what the Barbenheimer phenomenon, says about cinema, about us, about people, about the culture right now. Maybe not so much the actual movies themselves, but rather that it is a cultural phenomenon. But I just firstly want to say, as a film goer, I have to just firstly say how amazing it was to go to the cinemas this past weekend and it just be chock-a-block. People buying tickets, lining up, people just being stacked in amongst all these other film goers, maybe people who aren't usually at the cinema. It felt honestly quite magical. It feels like cinema is back again. It's like what happened with Maverick, but times a million. It feels like we're from another time, that we're living through another time, and it's just so exciting because it might even happen again. You know, I just hope that the studios and filmmakers can see the potential in this and want it to keep happening every summer or I guess it's winter here. But for all the summer blockbusters, etc., because it was just a fantastic weekend. I just had such a great time. But we're specifically going to focus on the Barbenheimer phenomena, what it is, why it came to be, what it says about the culture, everything like that. And we are going to kind of look at the films themselves and try and figure out what they're able to tell us about, you know, about the world around us like we usually do. But sometimes, as you know, we sometimes look at films as kind of indicators or yardsticks or sort of litmus tests for what appeals or maybe doesn't appeal to the culture. Like in other words, what the existence rather than the film itself, or what the existence of a film might say about the culture that produced it. So this week we're kind of doing that, but about the Barbenheimer phenomena. So we're talking about what does the existence of the Barbenheimer phenomena say about the current cultural climate? And in doing so, of course, we will talk about the films, but we're also going to have a look at another film that I think sort of encapsulates the entirety of this whole conversation in general. So of course, we're going to talk about Barbie, directed by Greta Gerwig, that just came out, and Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan. But we're going to finish off talking about the Lars von Trier film Melancholia from 2011, and I hope that'll make sense as we get to it. But let's kick things off now with some general comments about Barbenheimer itself. So let's ask this question: what accounts for this phenomenon? I think it's pretty clear that it's kind of based around the hilarity found in the fact that the two films are so diametrically or starkly different in kind of almost every aspect. I mean, their tone, you know, the respective tones are completely different, both visually and thematically. You know, obviously Barbie's got the pastel colours and is just very generally very colourful and pink, and Oppenheimer is literally black and white and very dark and everything like that. And, you know, the extent to which they kind of, let's say, embody a sense of femininity versus masculinity. You could sort of read a battle of the sexes thing going on here in a very stereotypical fashion. I won't go as far to say that, but you could say that Barbie has a much more feminine or stereotypically feminine look, and Oppenheimer has a stereotypically masculine look about it. The respective lengths of the film is worth mentioning as well. And I guess kind of like the general purpose, like I've seen a lot of the memes, like people talking about like Barbie, you know, you go to Oppenheimer, you're smoking a cigarette and drinking a cup of coffee, and so, you know, it's about getting deep and getting dramatic and really thinking about the tough things about life. First, Barbie's about going out with the girls, getting dressed up and drinking some mimosas and things like that. Almost said drinking some samosas. They're delicious, but you wouldn't have a samosa with Barbie. But why is that particularly funny that they're so starkly different? Well, there seems to be something funny about the fact that, like, to human beings, about the fact that two completely opposite things can appeal to the exact same species, right? That we can have two completely opposite things that appeal to humans of all kinds at the exact, so not only to the same culture, but at the exact same time. I suppose you might call this in-group versus out-group dynamics if you're talking about sort of like the theory of comedy and things like that. So you could say it's a little bit like the same, the Barbenheimer thing kind of has the same quality as like when a stand-up makes jokes about, like, you know, isn't it funny how men are like this but women are like this, or black people are like this but white people are like this. Like, there's this sort of ultra-perceptiveness that we greet with a sense of positivity and reinforcement. So, you know, when someone can read into the culture things and particular traits and see specific patterns and notice them and talk about them and celebrate them, we kind of like to congratulate that person for being so perceptive and giving us insights into ourselves. But I think it's also like a tool for self-realization as well. We kind of feel this sense of joy in finding our people, but not only finding our people, but separating ourselves from those we're not. So it's a bit like those like BuzzFeed quizzes where it's like, which Harry Potter character are you? And it's a bit like that. It's like, are you a Barbie person? Are you an Oppenheimer person? But that's not quite it, because at the core of this Barbenheimer phenomenon, it's not just that they're such different films. It's also about the fact that despite them being so different, there's this whole double feature thing going on where you have to see them both in the same day or on the same weekend, as I did, obviously. Hence why the cinemas have been so full, because it's not just that people are seeing one film or the other, but everyone is seeing both of them, either back-to-back on a Saturday, Sunday, on the same day kind of thing. So, and it kind of feels like people have this maybe like this obligation to access and embrace sort of the two wolves inside them, both people inside their psyche. We talk about the duality of mankind a lot on this show. We did a whole episode on the duality of man. We've talked about the inner rational, the inner irrational, the inner conservative and the inner progressive, the shadow self, the anima and the animus. And the memes have been about that as well. You know, everyone has two sides and they've got like the split down the middle thing. So it is this kind of embrace of the duality of man. And I kind of would think there's a bit of runoff. This is a bit of a runoff system from the post-truth anti-echo chamber era. Like, ever since like post-2016, people are kind of like, I got to give things a try that I'm not habitually drawn to. And I kind of feel like people are kind of trying to do their due diligence, make sure they're not just being, like you see those pictures of like Cillian Murphy going to see Barbie and Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie going to see Oppenheimer. It's kind of like, it's a celebrated thing now to kind of do the opposite thing, to listen to the other side of the aisle's arguments. I don't think it's a deeply political thing as such, because I don't think the films have the opposite politics, or at least in the obvious sense. But I do think there is something admirable about sort of giving love to, you know, both the dark and gloomy, but also the bright and colourful. So let's ask the broader questions now. How do the films achieve kind of this embrace of the duality of mankind? And what does this say about that duality itself? But also, what does this yearning to embrace this inner duality say about us? Well, in order to ask that question, let's actually look at the film specifically and compare and contrast them and see kind of why they kind of maybe complement each other. And we can see if we can sort of look at that from a holistic or comprehensive position. So if we're talking firstly about Barbie, it centers on Barbie, who's an individual person who's this exceptionally beautiful woman who's coming to terms with these intrusive thoughts that she's having sort of inside her own mind about who she is and what she's all about. And if we want to sort of focus on the main takeaways, and as I said, we're not going to focus too much on the films or on their own too much. We're kind of going to talk about them scattered throughout today's conversation. But the main thing I want to talk about this film is you know, when it first hit the preview screens, people went wild. It caught so many people's attention. The sheer existence of this film is almost more interesting than the film itself. It's almost as if, I want to specifically talk about women, because it just seems to be in the culture that women were particularly more drawn to this film than men, for obvious reasons. It's almost like women, and particularly young women, have been begging for someone with a kind of A-grade feminist perceptiveness, such as Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie, I suppose, to tell us, but specifically Greta Gerwig, because the Greta Gerwig thing is huge right now. You know, with Lady Bird and Little Women, she is kind of like the go-to person to find out whether it's okay to do this as a feminist or vice versa. And I kind of think that people really want to know, right, is this Barbie archetype? And I specifically use the word archetype and not stereotype, because I kind of think what Barbie actually represents, not just the blonde-haired one, but the Barbie figure is the personification or the dollification of feminine perfection. So, and why I don't use the word stereotype is because Barbie isn't just the blonde hair, blue eye, look at me, I'm just a girl. She does have the pilot's jacket, and what it's meant to be is representative of the ideal feminine. Now, when we use the word Barbie, that might evoke blonde hair and blue eyes, but when you look at on the shelves of the toy store, that's what the archetype is supposed to be. And sort of in the current environment, it sort of feels like women have been sort of underpinned by this constant state of contradiction and paradox, which is best put by the America Ferrera character in the film, and that's sort of the anchor of the whole film. But in sort of blunt terms, it's kind of like you kind of have to be both Instagram certified gorgeous, like this Kim Kardashian level beautiful, but also you have to be smashing the glass ceiling. You've got to be killing it in the corporate world. You've got to have an HD average at university. You've got to have lots of money. And there's too many things to be able to do all at once to fit this very, very high standard, this very high threshold of what kind of seems to be sort of the bar. Anything short of that is insufficient. So the film is kind of talking about how that this is sense on the level of the individual right now, particularly the individual feminine figure, there is so much that one has to do, and this leads to a huge wave of grievances and an overwhelming sense of pressure in wanting to be Margaret. You know, it's important that like Margaret Robbie is like, you know, the most beautiful woman in the world. You have to aspire to be that level in order to be sufficient in this world, and that causes a great deal of stress and anxiety. And what is one supposed to do about that? Not everyone can be Margot Robbie. There can only be one Margot Robbie. It's quite a I don't want to go as far as it's a horrific situation, but it can be very detrimental to one's mental health, obviously. But it can be a very difficult thing to have to come to terms with. I think that's why so many people were drawn to this film. And I think with the film, at the very least, what it does, and I didn't love the film, if I'm being completely honest. There were aspects of it that I thought were a little bit of a letdown. Just in terms of the plot development and things like that. But I think one of the strengths of the film was that it definitely meditates in that space for its entirety. We definitely connect with this sense of I can't maintain a plastic perfect sense of purity for the entire longevity of my life. Eventually I'm going to become a parent, a grandparent, an old person, and in that entire lifespan things are going to change in me. I'm not just going to have this static plastic. And obviously Barbie being, you know, the Barbie character, I don't want to give away the film too much if you haven't seen it, but there's definitely a question around the positivity in transforming from the plastic to the organic and seeing that as something that's positive, not a negative thing, and embracing the humanness of being human rather than that kind of psychopathic element that interestingly we see a lot in the meme culture today with lots of stuff like Patrick Bateman and stuff for guys and you know, the Ryan Gosling meme of him being, you know, the drive character and that having this very static kind of idyllic quality amongst young men, whereas in this film what he learns that he needs to embrace a sort of sense of individuality, not psychopathy, not a machine level, you know, a done-to-death kind of stereotypical constantly obsessed with making lots of money kind of guy, but learning to be an actual individual human being made of flesh and blood and bone rather than just a commodity, let's say. But this is all happening on the level of the individual. It's all about individual development and concerns and grievances on the individual level. What about some of the bigger things that we have to deal with in life, right? Well, that's what Oppenheimer, I think, is more about, and why there is such a stark difference, particularly on a thematic level, between these two films. So the plot of Oppenheimer is the story of, again, an individual, and we're going to talk about why that's significant in a second, but he's responsible for the atomic bomb, which essentially puts the entire world on notice. It's like putting a gun up to not just human beings that exist today, but every human being that could ever exist in this on this earth, and I guess in the entire universe at this point, because we don't live on any more than one planet. And if I can just put it very, very succinctly at this point of the show, this film is ultimately, to me, a wake-up call. I mean, it was really interesting this week in going to the film, going to the cinemas, because we were there with other people and, you know, I was talking in the lines and there was people behind me talking. They were eavesdropping while we were talking. We started talking together. And when we were sitting in a cinema for Oppenheimer, this chap in front of me actually turned around because we were talking about some just the historic facts around. And he turned around and he said, "Hey, no spoilers." I was like, "Mate, it's a biopic. How can there be spoilers? Don't you know that there's going to, like, do you not know that there's going to be an atomic bomb in this movie? Like, do you not know his first name is Robert? Like, spoilers in a biopic." And it made me realize, and as you watch the film, you know, at the core of this film is that it's a wake-up call that we now live in times where the trajectory of international relations is utter destruction, and that is at the mercy or subject to so many other intricate sub-themes that really are very terrifying. So it's not just that we have the power to blow up the world, but there is a great deal of plurality And the ensuing friction from plurality is this very scary ideological warfare. And the film spends a lot of time talking about Oppenheimer's relationship with communism and the Communist Party. And I think that's super important, because what the film is getting at is talking about that you can have an individual scientist with a great deal of genius, but if you have other stakeholders, particularly politicians who aren't scientists, so there's already a difference there, but who are of a different political program, a different political agenda, a different framework of morality, that just compounds and compounds, much like how the neutrons themselves set off this domino effect, this flow-on effect. You have this compounding sense of friction and difference between these specific individuals, which, pardon the pun, blows up into a complete mess, the fact that all of these things are piling up on top of each other. And this whole idea of culmination and ascension and things becoming out of control in a spiraling kind of sense is so perfectly depicted in the film, particularly in the score, and how little things build up gradual and gradual to the point that we get to a point of complete calamity, as is very obvious in the film. So we have this motif that shows up in a lot of different ways, but this motif of stockpiling, of amassing, of accumulation, let's say, not just of arms and means through which people can make bombs, but also in interpersonal tensions. And the reason I say all that is, if you have these individual differences between people, the way that those play out is, right, if you have this moral relativism where every individual has their own individual sense of morality, or you know, so much ideological friction, so much ideological tension between different groups and different individuals, that's the worst thing that you can have at a time when nuclear bombs exist, because all it takes is just one person to be of that specific ideology. And, you know, in a postmodern world where everyone can have their own individual framework, their own individual ideology, their own subspecies of communism or capitalism or liberalism, as long as you have one person whose ideology it is to blow up the world, and I don't need to meet them, there's someone out there, there's someone that would listening to this be like, that's me, right? There's 8 billion of us out there. As long as you have one person who's not even willing to do that, but capable of making the mistake of thinking that that is something that is worth doing, or is worth, or is even just worth risking, and that's kind of what the Robert Downey Jr. character is. Like, as long as you have one person in a position of power that might lead to a state of, might just be so flimsy and have such a sense of willful blindness that they can by accident press that button, it's over for all of us, right? It's over for every single individual. It's over for the entire world. So when we're watching the film Oppenheimer, we're talking about very big concepts like the end of the world, like ideologies, and it kind of makes Barbie's problems look very small in comparison, isn't it? And you could say, just on a sort of poetic level, it really is a question of, you know, Barbenheimer is really all about comparing the very, very big and the very, very small. You know, we're comparing atomic bombs with a doll in a dollhouse, like a smaller version of just an individual person. But I don't feel like these films are completely at odds. In fact, the more that we talk about them, the more they seem the same. We've got this idea that they're both focusing specifically on individuals, but how their actions can have all sorts of different consequences on the wider world and things like that in different ways. Is there a film that kind of sums all this up really well? But before we get into that, let's just remind you, dear listener, you are listening to 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming coming up here on 2XX. Also, jump onto our website, because it's to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. That would be very much appreciated. But let's finish things off now with Lars von Trier's film Melancholia, which hasn't got a mention in the memes or anything of late, but I think it's a very apt film to talk about this week. So if you haven't seen the film, it's the story of two sisters, and it's in two parts, one part for each sister. And the first one is that one sister is this beautiful blonde bride played by Kirsten Dunst, who in the first part of the film is battling through her wedding day as she fights off this overwhelming sense of debilitating depression. And the other sister is played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. And after previously working very tirelessly and kind of in a state of frustration to help her sister, who was riddled with depression, she herself is sort of riddled with the state of anxiety by this incoming planet, very aptly named Melancholia, that's about to collide with Earth, and that makes up the second part of the film. So, I'm not going to deny the fact that this film is very quite obviously about depression. You know, it's called Melancholia. It's the second film in von Trier's depression trilogy. But for the sake of today's conversation, I want to kind of broaden it out just slightly and talk about it more about, not just about depression, but causes for concern, causes of grief, things that cause us grief, things that make us concerned, things that basically the spectrum of the those things sit on. You know, being worried about something, paying attention to something grabbing our attention because it rubs us the wrong way, let's say. But let's actually go through the film sort of in a chronological order and talk about how it kind of unpacks this spectrum of causes for concern. Well, in the first part, the part about Kirsten Dunst's character, there is this sense of frustration that Charlotte Gainsbourg feels in having to look after Kirsten Dunst's character, and like a lot of the characters, Kiefer Sutherland's character as well, and her mother as well, sort of feel after looking after her sister. And we kind of feel like on a very prejudicial level that maybe Kirsten Dunst is a little bit too indulgent, a little bit too self-obsessed, a little bit too egotistical. And that is sort of a prejudiced view, but it nonetheless is kind of there, and we kind of feel it when we watch this film, certainly within the characters. And it gives us this sense that the characters kind of feel like depression is something that someone can avoid with enough willpower, with enough might. You can stop caring about things so much. You can stop blowing things out of proportion if you sort of just get on with it, sort of grow up a little bit and use the right strategies. And then the second part, there's this sense of maybe ignorance or comeuppance in the Charlotte Gainsbourg's character that sort of becomes revealed when she herself becomes depressed or anxious by this other planet that's coming to destroy Earth. So in the whole first part, she's sort of like, come on, cheer up, get better, you've got to be better, this is frustrating. And the second part, she's like, well, actually, now I'm starting to feel a little bit off, actually. And so there's kind of a few important things to say here. The first thing is the obvious thing, which is that melancholia, right, depression, is inevitable and it's unstoppable. It's as unstoppable as a planet coming to collide Earth. You might have all the strategies in the world, but life is undeniably full of things that make us depressed and anxious, and trying to put them off is akin to putting off a planet colliding with Earth. So everyone can get depressed. It's kind of just a matter of the kind of depressed person you are. And you could very kind of in a general sense say that Kirsten Dunst's character kind of has a little bit of a Barbie aspect to her, not just in her beauty and her blondness, although those sort of help for the sake of the point that I'm trying to make, but the fact that her causes for concern kind of exist on the level of the individual, sort of what she's dealing with in the there and the then. Let's call it the microcosmic level, not the microscopic, I'm not saying it's small, but on the micro level, right, on the level of the individual. Whereas Charlotte Gainsbourg's cause for concern, the cause of her grievances, her mental illness, her mental health or her anxiety or depression, is staged on the macro level, the macrocosmic level, in that she fears for what's going to happen to the people outside of her, namely her son. So we have this sliding spectrum here, right? The micro, the cosmic level concern, and the macrocosmic level concern. But what I think is particularly interesting is not so much what makes the characters depressed, but what doesn't. So Charlotte Gainsbourg's character can't really relate to Kirsten Dunst's constant state of depression in the first part of the film, particularly because it's meant to be the happiest day of her life, i.e. it's her wedding, which I think is very important. It's very useful that they use that as a metaphor. But Kirsten Dunst is almost sort of glad that the world is ending, given that her usual state is a constant state of torturous depression on the everyday level, which is also a very Lars von Trier, that's in Antichrist as well, that the everyday, that the world itself, the reality itself is very depressing. So she almost becomes kind of disdainful for Charlotte Gainsbourg when she becomes when she becomes, you know, mentally unwell, because she's like, you put me down the whole time, you made me feel stupid for being depressed, now you're depressed, now you'll see how it feels. But there is also this kind of beautiful sense of optimism in the film, despite these horrible moments of, you know, Kirsten Dunst crying through the whole first part of the film and you know, the whole earth being destroyed. Because both become each other's caretaker when the other is in a state of depression. It's almost like because one only deals with it on the microcosmic level, that allows her to deal with macrocosmic concerns all right, because, you know, the microcosmic is bad enough, so she kind of doesn't, in comparison, doesn't matter, and vice versa, right? So what does this say about the Barbenheimer tension, right? Well, when we spoke about Barbie, we talked about the immense sense of stress an individual might feel when tasked with maintaining a sense of perfection in all places at all times, at the level of the individual. When we spoke about Oppenheim, we kind of got this sense that the grievance of the individual are really almost a cause for concern, and dare I say somewhat meaningless or immaterial in the face of existential threats. And our attention should really be to the broader existential bigger ideas rather than the relatively minor problems going on the level of the individual. What does it matter if you have interpersonal problems with other people? What does it matter if you have wrinkles on your face? If the whole world is going to end, none of those things matter. But I think when you look at a film like Melancholia, we can't really solve one of those problems and not the other, right? If we're unable to relate to the grievances of the individual, we lose their support. We're unable to access their assistance or their expertise. Or even worse, they could even become a liability or even an agent of destruction themselves. You know, if they feel like we don't care about them as an individual, life for them is torture. So what do they care if the whole world ends? What do they care about flipping the border? It sort of suits them, actually, at that point, and it can take them out of their misery. And if we consider Oppenheimer in all of its grandiosity, the film is literally about an individual. It's not called the atomic bomb. It's not called World War III. It's called Oppenheimer. It's about a specific individual and his relationships with other individuals, particularly Robert Downey Jr. And on the level of the individual is actually, it's as we've sort of touched on, it's super important to what actually happens to these characters and to all of us in history. So the individual can't be ignored. And furthermore, we can't underestimate the use of the individual, even if they don't care about existential problems. Their use in an existential scenario, right? For it's their numbness in the face of an existential crisis that allows them to think much more clearly and much less emotionally, to be that rock that we can hold to in the face of existential calamity. Because it might be the case that when the bomb is about to fall and the ultraviolet lights as bright as the sun are about to flare out and destroy us, maybe we need that stylish someone to recommend us a pair of new shades. Well, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in for a very special episode, and please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX if you stick around. But also jump onto our website to consider sponsoring the show or subscribing to the station. That would be fantastic. And also get in touch with me. You can email me at contact@jimmyberlusconi.com. Cheers, I'll see you next week.